are listening to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. This episode features Lone Mountain Fellow, Professor John Briscoe from Harvard University, discussing the challenge of water in a changing world. Interviewed by PERC Graduate Fellow Katie Hansen of Oxford University.
Mr. Briscoe, thank you very much for joining us at PERC today. To start, I'm interested in hearing about your 30-plus years of experience on the ground. And I'm wondering, when you were in Pakistan, how did you assess and approach water challenges in that country?
Well, the Pakistan is a really, really fascinating case because you've got a country that's truly is a sort of hydraulic, so, you know, the whole country lives on one river. Mm-hmm. And the river's vulnerable to India on the one side and then the Himalayas and what's happening there, and then massive mismanagement internally. But, you know, we're going to be doing a project with the business school, and Pakistan's a very interesting case because this is how I like to operate. Right? Mm-hmm. The 60% of GDP of Pakistan is the province of Punjab. Mm-hmm. And the chief minister of Punjab, he's a businessman. So he understands that their water vulnerability is tremendous, and this is affecting everybody. So I'm actually for a few years been on an advisory board that he has. Mm-hmm. But I can't come in and tell him, you've got to price water, or you've got to integrate. Oh, this is... So I said, okay, he wants to be, his brother wants to be the prime minister. His brother was the prime minister before. What's a vision for a politician? So he said, the vision of how do we share scarcity is not a vision politician. They want affirmative visions. So he said, look, the vision should be that Punjab becomes a regional agricultural superpower. Mm. Why aren't you, you should be producing four times, there's not a short, you've got water, you've got land, you've got sun, you've got access to market, you've got smart people. Why aren't you producing four times much? What are the constraints to produce? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is. I want to be a president who runs on, we're going to become a superpower. This is interesting. Yes, and so there are many pieces you have to put in, a whole bunch of, intellectual property rights and all sorts of things. But you can't have a water system from the 1850s underpinning this. It's not going to work. So what is a water system? And then into that, you start getting the private sector because there are people who are managing it. So how do we generalize this? How do we engage influential farmers who have done this already? Mm-hmm. How do you get the Monsantos, everybody? So how do you create this? And what I like to do is to help put those, we're going to do this with the business school next year, put these together and then see what, I'm not so much one for, there's some things, right? So people have to look at risk, they have to look at what it produces in that. Mm-hmm. So there's some things, but then let's see what comes, and let's try and solve that problem. Don't come in and say, the water person said you must do that. No, you've got to see where the space is and what can be done and where are the soft parts where you can advance and what's that sort of the politics of reform. Because it is political. It must be political. Mm-hmm. How do you engage with that?
Mm. Yeah. It's all about markets and property rights.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I've read of yours is focused on infrastructure and institutions and innovation, and I'm wondering how you think markets and property rights fit into that sort of three-I.
I think very, very much so, very much so, in the sense that, I think the sort of the naive, just give a property right and everything's solved. I don't think that's not serious. And we had at the bank, we had people who did that. It's just not serious. Mm-hmm. So you have to deal with the infrastructure. You have to deal with the institution. But do you want, you take the Pakistan case. If I went and start talking about a water market, this is crazy. But if I start saying, look, the only way we can get productivity up is if people have predictability and on-demand service. So how are we going to move towards giving what the farmer knows he needs? When he needs water, how does he do it? Mm-hmm. So whose water is it? Who is it to give away? And then you sort of back into, I have to do this because that's what's needed to solve this problem, rather than it is the principle and now I'm going to try and organize everything else around it. Mm-hmm. And, for me, the same on infrastructure. I'm not interested in infrastructure per se, but what problem is it trying to solve and how are we... Mm-hmm. So, each of these is, for me, is a piece. And the markets is also, hugely dependent on broader forces. Like that's actually the great misinterpretation, I think, of the Australian one. The Australian one, I mentioned this one piece of it, but it was one that was so deeply embedded in a whole reform process of the society as a whole. It wasn't a reform, it wasn't a water reform, it was a reform of the way their whole society operated, and water was, that's what gave water the space to do. It wasn't because somebody said, we're going to do this for water. It would never have lasted a week in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look, the other great case is the Chilean, which is in many ways exactly the same as Australia. You had an overarching view of a market economy, and then this fit with it. Now, if you have an overarching view that's completely different, if you have a Brazil, for example, which this doesn't pertain, you can't use that instrument. That's not, so you've got to look at incentives in in what God gives you, what, you know. And that's the, for me, the critical thing. Try to see the problem as clearly as possible and then have a toolbox which has all sorts of things in it to try and come in and say it. And especially the ultimate test is to say to the politician, I can help you. He says, yes, that's what I want. Rather, he's not interested in broad principles or integrated management or price. He's not, he wants to find what can work.
Recently, academics and practitioners have really pushed bottom-up solutions, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on the movement.
So I think it's a great, great illusion. Without, not in as much as, of course, at the end of the day, you know, individuals have to do things. But if there's not a, if that doesn't coexist with a structure and a both. A structure that's both institutional and infrastructure at a large level, the individuals can solve some small problems, and then they can create a lot of other problems. So you do need, it's just a bit of the markets. The markets need regulations and laws, and they need public goods to be, all of, without that, they can't function. And the same, I think, with all of this. So the that's what, you know, what for me, just going back to the Ghana thing, this sort of, this notion of, well, the NGO will solve it and the individual will solve it, but the state, and not only the part that I really object to is not, you know, fine, okay, whatever, but that we don't need a state. We don't need, you know, so Accra doesn't need a water tube. What are you talking about? I mean, what city that you're going to have everybody, you know, what are they doing? Digging where every person's digging their own well, everybody's carrying. So it's simply, so is it a part? Yeah, it's a part. It's got something. Right. But is it, and I think it's a, I think it's an indulgence in many ways. You know, even if you look, like, it's very interesting. In Cambridge, we have many panels on innovation. I mean, there was on one recently, MIT had one on water innovation. So the, everybody wants to do an NGO or a startup. The startup's the second thing. And all of them are something from nothing, right? I've got, you know, I can do desal for 10 cents a kilo. I've got the technology.
Right.
And of course, you know, they never really are.
Right.
It's very interesting. This was a panel, and, you know, especially around MIT, there were all of these spin-offs. And they all got this, you know, their silver bullet for some particular problem. And on this panel, we also had GE. And I had actually just been the week before to GE, and I said to them, you know, what do you make of all these startups? And they said, well, you know, the good ones we buy. But we, GE, they said, spend more, our venture capital in the water business is more than all of the startups put together, which may or may not be exactly true, but it's probably true. And so on this panel was a guy from GE. And so all the startups were, you know, I've got this solution, I've got this solution. And then so I said, so gee, what do you do in this space? Very interesting. They said, we manage risk for clients. That's what GE does. And this is, I thought it was really terrific, because it's much the same as I think about this. Is, yeah, I'm not coming with a solution and then saying, so where's the problem? I'm going to apply my solution. Basically, GE says, let's say you're the government of Punjab. I have a problem. What's the problem? How am I going to enable you to manage this? And that's going to be institutions, software, hardware, all sorts of things are going to go into. So first I have to understand what your problem is. And then seeing your problem, I then have to be able to enable you to manage this problem. And then I have to bring whatever the instruments that are for it, rather than, you know, the startup is, yeah. The, and The other thing I think that's, you know, it's, the Australian case is really interesting in this, is once you get incentives aligned, then you get like, boy, you know, you should see in Australia all the use of IT in that is just in census and it's just going mad because water has value.
Yeah.
So the idea, you know, that well, I can just in a disembodied way produce. So they say, well, you know, should we be measuring? I said, well, depends. I mean, if it's got value, people are going to measure. If it doesn't have any value, why should I measure it? So all of those. You know, and so I think that's, for me, that's a key, really, in a way, the key thing. So really trying to look in an almost disinterested way at what is the water problem, what's the broader problem, and then try to say, okay, so now, if I understand that, there are going to be some things that are in play and some things that are not in play. And then markets and things, maybe in some cases, maybe a lot in some cases, but depends on. Contextualize and solve some things and don't solve some other things.
What is the best way to increase investments in the water sector?
That's a big problem. So it's not quite what you asked, but there's an interesting, if you look at, you know, you look back the last 15, 20 years with private sector capital coming, and you look at in the developing markets, you know, 10 years ago, you had, you know, Enron had a subsidiary working on water. There were the French companies. This was boom city, right? This is going to be. And then you look 10 years later and you see telecoms, you know, $60, $80 billion a year in developing markets. Energy, maybe $30, $40 billion a year. Even transport, a lot of investment. And water is virtually nothing. And the reason is fairly, you know, it's fairly obvious in a way. And that is, water supply is very, very capital intensive. It's actually very old, mostly old technology. But if you look at the ratio of revenue per capital invested, it's very, very, very much lower than it is for, say, telecoms or transport, any of these. What that means is you have, if you look at the cash flow from investing, you have negative cash flow. If you, for example, if you build a big water treatment plant or you build a distribution system, you've got negative cash flow for 15 years. And then you make your money in the last 10 or 15 years. But what happens if you get to year 14 and somebody nationalizes you? You've just had bleeding cash and all of the returns are gone. And the instability of the water, and largely with, in my view, you know, this is where the sort of the human rights and all this community plays an incredibly damaging role because this is, you know, is this constant, it shouldn't be, a private is bad, etc. And of course, so, you know, if I'm a really smart, I say, private sector, come on, you're 14, I'm going to nationalize you. And then I'll take all of the plus side on that. And there have been enough cases of that that basically nobody's doing it anymore. Unless, again, it's been done in cases where there's a high degree of there's a very great specificity to the context in which this takes place. So, for example, Manila, which is probably the greatest case of success, was a case, it's a domestic company, it's a company called Ayala Corporation, who were very close to the president. There was a whole perception in the Philippines. And the ultimate part was it was key to attracting private investment into the Philippines was having this. And so they knew the system well enough that they could secure. But this is exceptional.
And in neighboring Malaysia, right, who are issuing some sort of government bonds on.
So if you get that security, you know, capital will come in.
Right.
But if you don't have that, it's so, you know, the cases, many of these cases are not. The maintenance of infrastructure, you know, it's, you know, I don't know, maybe that's what happens when you get old, you know, but it's interesting because for me, I see this, I see your generation in a way, but generations before that. You've all grown up with no knowledge of scarcity, more or less of anything. You've never had, you know, Washington D.C. is without power for a week. This is a transcendent calamity. Everybody's had power, everybody's had water, everybody in the Mississippi has been protected from floods, everybody. And, you know, we built all this stuff and it doesn't need much maintenance for a while. But, you know, this is, we've got this massive stock And we're not... Now, what happens? Mm-hmm. What happens when it all starts collapsing? Not just one bridge. You know, I live in Boston. All of the bridges are just rusting away before your eyes, you know? And what public money do we have for this? After we've done with Social Security, there's nothing left. And all the entire... There's nothing left for that.
Right.
So the need for a sort of dramatic revision in how this... And, you know, the municipalities can't... You know, nobody can raise bond. I mean,
you can't
sort of,
run on that.
You can't do it. You know, it's. Right. I mean, it's a. And this is. It's very interesting. On this work we did on the Mississippi with the Mississippi River Commission, the general, who's a very, very bright guy, and I said, "So, General, what's the thing that wakes you up at 4 o'clock?" He says, "The maintenance." He says, "I don't know how we're going to maintain this. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we. You know, you have a big flood. There's $several billion just to put it back again, and this has to be done in perpetuity. You know, and this is." And I think there's a, you know, there's sort of a, I mean, it sounds a little harsh, but I see it like the rich countries are sort of massively indulgent. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I look at students. If I just say to a student, I want you to do a PhD on maintenance of infrastructure. You know, if I ask a student to invent a new, you know, filter for Ghanaian, I've got hundreds of them. Or, you know, a new environmental. And what is not understood, in my view, is that all of this is... This is a luxury good. It's a luxury for you to worry about Ghana. Mm-hmm. Why the hell are you worrying about Ghana, for God's sake? It's because you have no problem. You have a perception of we don't really have difficult problems anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to a degree, the environmental concerns are the same. They come, you know, what happens to environment? The moment, you know, the unemployment rate hits 8%, environment drops like a lead balloon because people are worried about jobs and getting... So I think that there's a sort of, you know, this is what it is to be American. Every generation is going to be better than the next. Mm-hmm. So it's so patently not true anymore. It's so patently not. So what happens mm-hmm. when it's, you know, and I think I start seeing glimpses already. It's very interesting. You see, you know, people like Tom Friedman write about this. You know, you look, here we can't build anything. You know, you can't build a damn thing because there's a, you know, an environment, there's a local community, there's this. And the Chinese do it all in a week. Now, oh, because they don't respect anyone. No, we did that before, too. That's how we built here. Mm-hmm. I had a fascinating interview. There's an interview. I had this weird juxtaposition a while ago when we were in Washington. There was a 20-year process mm-hmm. for widening. There's a bridge that goes over the Potomac in Alexandria, the mm-hmm. Wilson Bridge. There's a Wilson Bridge. Wilson Bridge. It's mm-hmm. 8 lanes, and they were widening it to 10 lanes. Who cares if it's 8 or 10 lanes? And it was 20 years, and I don't know, $40 million of environmental impact studies for something that was like, really? I mean, it wasn't even building the bridge. It was just another lane on the damn thing. And then when that was going on, I heard an interview on NPR. There was a guy who was like the last surviving person who had worked on the first interstate highway in the United States, or the first, what they call a turnpike. And it turned out it wasn't an interstate, it was from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And he was in his 90s or so. So they said, mm-hmm. so tell us about this. I said, well, you know, they decided we needed, there were value to faster communication. Mm-hmm. And so we started and we finished in 2 years. They said, from the time it was decided to do it, to completion of the thing, was 2 years.
Yeah.
So they said, well, what about environment? We didn't do any of that. And so what did you do when you came to a city? He says, well, we sort of, you know, did the tarmac up the city and we said, should we go through or go around? We either went through or we went around. And the whole thing was done in 2 years. And this is in a way, you know, now it seems, you know, oh my goodness, all of the negative effects, but the negative effects of not doing things are enormous, enormous. And those are the, I mean, this was, you know, this was a mantra for me in the World Bank, as we say. Well, what's the risk of doing this and this and we need a loan? I said, yeah, okay, so that's... And then what's the risk of not doing anything? What are the consequences of not doing things? Mm-hmm. And those, I think, are consequences. My perception is sort of this generation thinks they're no consequence. So what if we mm-hmm. don't have the Keystone Pipeline? So what if we don't have, we'll preserve? At the end, something's going to happen from all of it.
Right.
And then that comes back to the politics. Then what happens in politics? Then what happens when there's no electricity anymore? Then see how the balance of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of almost getting ready for that day. And mm-hmm. it sounds a little apocalyptic, I know, but it's towards, so what do we do to maintain this mm-hmm. quality of life and this quality of life? And all of the taken for givens, I don't think very many of them are givens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we get into just the tremendous rigidities we have, the inability mm-hmm. to even simple things to get them done. Yes. And this mm-hmm. again, this Mississippi case, fascinating. You see, it's a case of a pump that was to be installed in a part of the delta there. And the process had been going for 71 years. It's obvious it should be done. It was blocked by the OMB. It was blocked. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. blocked by EPA. It was blocked, blocked, blocked. And it's a simple case. That, you know, again, if it was China, it would have been done 2 weeks after that.
Right, so, right.
So these are, but I think it all comes back to the thing of trying to see the reality and then trying to see how that
right. I think we're about out of time, good. But okay. I wanted to say, we've talked a lot about the challenges and what keeps people up at night.
Yeah.
What gives you peace at the end of the day? What are you hopeful for?
You know, it's interesting, it's fascinating for me to be a professor. I was a professor once many years ago. I found it crushingly boring. Because right? I don't think I had much to teach except what I learned in books, and so it wasn't right. very interesting. And very interesting for me because, I mean, I'm in a particular milieu, right? So Harvard is very, you know, there's a particular worldview amongst the faculty. I end up, one of the things that Harvard does is it's a great money machine. In fact, that's probably the main thing it does. It's raises money. Right? Mm-hmm. And so partially because what I do, everybody gives lip service to multidisciplinary cutting across, where in fact the institution is, as with all universities, entirely the rewards are for doing things within very narrow areas. Mm-hmm. But I'm not 30 years old, so I don't have to do it that way. So this is perceived as being terrific, the university is doing this. And so I give talks to alumni, and actually when they have every class of 30 years has to raise more than the one before did. And I gave one recently, it was very interesting. It was a group of maybe 12 or 15 from the class 30 years ago. And I described, you know, more or less what we talked about today. And they said, this is fascinating, this is great. And then one of the people said, this is very interesting, but how exactly do your colleagues think about your work you do? Because it's politically not, it's very incorrect, especially in the Cambridge. So, and it made me think of it, and it was very interesting, because I said, you know, I think the faculty, for the most part, are sort of horrified. I mean, this is like, you know, the water issue is about sustainability. I mean, that, and, you know, enormous thing. Isn't it wonderful that our students are going out and starting ceramic pot factories in Ghana, all of which I think should never be done. So it's a very different message. And the thing that's most interesting to me is I teach in fact, David comes and gives a class. Mm-hmm. I teach a large undergraduate class of 40 students mm-hmm. that's in environmental science and public policy. So all students who are moved by the environment issue, which is very good. And I basically present how I see things. What's very interesting to me is the reaction from students is I have never, and we have very elaborate evaluation system, never had a this guy should be, he's from the past century, this is stuff that is bygone, he hasn't caught up with the model. It's all like, this was so interesting because we've never heard this before. Mm-hmm. We've never heard this. And there, I think, what gives me hope is because, and then when we, like we did on this water federalism, you put out a thing for students to come and work in a different way. So it's very interesting in this because we said to students, look, all of this, in each of these basins, you're going to go back and look at what was a primary challenge, a response, a new challenge. Because the general sense is, these people are complete idiots. How did they do something so stupid as this? So understand that we are at a particular point in history that has it's no more special than anyone was earlier. Mm-hmm. We have no particular mm-hmm. intelligence that people didn't have earlier. Mm-hmm. They solved a series of problems, and our children are going to look at us and say, they were really stupid. Didn't they see that? And when I see what's coming, this is what I see coming. Mm-hmm. And I can see, you know, I could paint a picture of, you know, your children saying, what were you doing? Why are you worrying about those people in Ghana? Couldn't you see? you know, our whole place was about to fall apart. You didn't see that, mm-hmm. right? Didn't you read the ASCE D minus for interest? Didn't you read that? Didn't you pay? What did you do about that? Oh, nothing. I went off to solve Ghana's ceramic filter problem. Mm-hmm. You must be kidding, right? And I think that my sense is that and this is particularly in the university environment, there's just very little challenging. Students don't hear other points of view. They don't get, and I think part of this is practitioners. You don't have practitioners. It's people who spend their whole life, and a paper is something that has existence. And then mm-hmm. the world around, in the water area, for example, I find most of what happens in academia completely irrelevant. Mm-hmm. I can't even read it because it just seems like, what's that about? Right? And then you have these massive issues in practice to which nobody's paying any attention. Mm-hmm. So what I think about it is, the positive side is that young people, when given another frame of reference, another thing, jump to this mm-hmm. and are far less blinkered than our generation is. And this, I mean, I teach graduate students who already, you can see the blinkers mm-hmm. coming in, and then faculty, the minds are completely closed. Mm-hmm. And I think that this opportunity to get young people who are open to seeing the world in another way mm-hmm. is enormously positive, but it needs a lot of people to jump in and to do that.
What training is required for a career focused on addressing water challenges?
Do something that's really going to stretch you. Mm-hmm. This is, you don't go to, why go to school to just patch mm-hmm. things together? Mm-hmm. Then you should be saying, so what do I do that really is going to enhance my skills?
Right.
That's what you want to ask, mm-hmm. rather than is it this or is it that? Because mm-hmm. actually, and you know, if you're doing that, the other great thing is then you want to get your hands dirty. Mm-hmm. Right? So my sense is, so how could something like that work? Is to say, okay, I mean, like I have a bunch of students, the Australian one is so interesting, they have fabulous data and mm-hmm. it's hugely interesting and it's mm-hmm. super easy access and mm-hmm. there's no, you know, everything is easy mm-hmm. in it. To say, okay, I would like to work for a couple of years, it doesn't matter whether it's doing a degree or a post or whatever, mm-hmm. in which I'm immersed in that particular part of practice, mm-hmm. but with the foot all the time asking questions of theory and of principle. Now, you have to then be able to pull together the pieces. Mm-hmm. Who is going to, you know, for example, I mean, yeah, most fundamentally, the stuff you need to understand statistics in a, because mm-hmm. that's all of what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. So you really have to get a sort of an applied statistics feel mm-hmm. for how do I think about mm-hmm. Variability, which is mm-hmm. so difficult for people to think about. Mm-hmm. So we can think of, you know, it's fascinating because anything of dealing with an uncertain event and then it doesn't happen. So, well, you see, it didn't. It's the most difficult area of communication and of getting mm-hmm. policy to work well.
Especially where perceptions are concerned. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and that, you know, I mean, that's also all of that's, you know, that's it's funny because I teach undergraduates a lot mm-hmm. too, and so I get a lot of, you know, oh, I don't really know what to do. What would you do if you were this? And I say, the thing that I would work on is, if I was that age, is I would work on like cognitive neuroscience now, because I think this, we are just starting to understand, like, mm-hmm. for example, things of risk. Mm-hmm. How does the brain, how do we actually think of these things? So that's part, you know, also, I mean, I've got students, psychology students that come in and think about this. You know, it's not, psychology is not all about, I don't know, whatever they do. It's thinking about these big questions, because there's such a disconnect mm-hmm. between our sort of technical tools and communication and mm-hmm. and intuition tools. There's this massive gap.
To find out more about Lone Mountain Fellows, visit www.perc.org.